Is there any way this can be turned off? I will be hoarse in 5 minutes. Thank you, Don. It's always a deep joy upon my part to come to Shenandoah, to your fine, lovely city. And I don't know how many of these lectureships I've spoken on. I think probably at least 8 or 10, but everyone has been a supreme delight. And I appreciate Don and Jackie, appreciate the good elders of this congregation and every member. And I value the books that have been put out very highly. Quite often I reach for one and do some research in it. And so all of us are indebted to the type of literature that has been put out here during these lectureships. And I'm especially delighted that we're making a study of great questions of the Bible. Questions take quite a variety within the Bible. We have questions that deal with the here and now, and we have questions in the Bible that deal with the there and then. Sometimes these questions are asked by deity and directed to men. Sometimes these questions come from men and are directed to the Godhead. Sometimes these questions come from individuals, sometimes the righteous toward the wicked, sometimes the wicked toward the righteous. And so there's a great variety of questions that are to be found in the Bible. And of course, the asking and answering of questions has always been a very fine way to come to conclusions and to come to a better knowledge of God's Word. All of us who have had children and now grandchildren, think about the hundreds and hundreds of questions that we have answered. Well, this is one of their ways of obtaining and eliciting information that they desire. And the very fact that we have so many hundreds of questions in the Bible, I think, lends emphasis to the importance of asking questions and answering questions. For many years, I've conducted open forums and various lectureships and many other capacities as well. And I appreciate people who have enough interest in asking questions and seeking answers. And so tonight, we study about one of the truly great, great questions of the Old Testament. As Don indicated, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? I want to approach our lesson tonight basically from these angles. I want to give something about the background or the context in which this question is asked. I want to deal briefly with the one that I believe that it is directed to. I want to suggest something about the analysis of this wonderful question. And then I want to talk about some of the judgments that God has given mankind and ultimately will give mankind come final judgment day. I believe that if I can do justice to these questions and these segments of our study, that our time will have been well spent this first hour. First of all, we have the setting or the context. And whenever we study a Bible topic, we ought to keep it in its context. Somebody has made the observation that a text taken out of its context becomes a mere pretext. And I think that's one of the reasons why many people come to wrong conclusions. They'll take a text or a question or a comment or a statement clear out of the context, not considering the verses that come before, the verses that come subsequently, or maybe the entire book from which it is taken. So I want to deal briefly with the context. In the early part of Genesis, the 18th chapter, we have three that make a visit to Abraham in the southern part of Palestine. My conviction is that two of them were created angels, and the other was actually a member of the Godhead. And I'm going to suggest in just a moment or two the particular member of the Godhead that I believe is involved in these three. But they come to Abraham, and Abraham, of course, not only being a great man of faith, a great man of character, a great man of reputation, he also was characterized by a great degree of hospitality. And he received them graciously. Perhaps the writer in Hebrews 13, 1 and 2 had Abraham in mind when he said, let brotherly love continue, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. But Abraham and Sarah practiced hospitality, and during that visit, and one of them is referred to as the Lord, they let it be known that Sarah is going to be with child. Now, the one that is designated as the Lord is the one that did that. He makes the promise to Abraham that Sarah is going to bear a son. She considered herself to be well beyond childbearing age, and when she heard it nearby, she laughed and later denied that she did laugh. And, of course, the Lord, being a member of the Godhead, being omniscient, all-knowing, he said, nay, but you did laugh. And, of course, they are reminded, Abraham and Sarah, that with the Lord, nothing is impossible. But in the conversation, we find that two of the angels go on to Sodom to try to get Lot and his family out of the doomed city of the Jordan Plain. And the one that is designated the Lord remains there. I have long been of the persuasion that this is actually a reference to the one that so many other times in the Old Testament is called the angel of the Lord or the angel of his presence. And I believe that's a reference to the second person of the Godhead. You'll remember when the people were on their way to Canaan, especially after they had sinned grievously in the wilderness, that the first person said that he would not be accompanying them, but he would send his angel. And that angel would have been the second person of the Godhead. Remember from 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, how that they drank of that rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. And so Christ accompanied them during the 40 years in which they dwelt in the wilderness. I believe there are dozens of other instances in the Old Testament where actually the angel of the Lord, and I don't believe that's a reference to Gabriel, I don't believe that's a reference to Michael, I don't believe that's a reference to any created being, but a reference to the second person of the Godhead. I made mention in the book about a great lecture that Brother Gary Summers delivered as we studied the Godhead at the Power Lectures about 5 years ago, 1998. And he dealt with the angel of the Lord, and I thought it was a brilliant message. And I heard him when he gave it initially, and then I read it carefully after the book came out or after I got the book. But I believe he presents a concrete case for the angel of the Lord, the angel of his presence, being the second member of the Godhead who often came at the behest of the Father to carry out missions here upon the earth. That's always seemed to me to be much more logical and much more scriptural than to designate the angel of the Lord and the angel of his presence as being someone like Gabriel or someone like Michael or one of the unnamed angels. But after the two had gone on to Sodom, the Lord and Abraham had the conversation that is recorded in the latter part of Genesis, the 18th chapter. And Abraham said, after learning that Sodom's destruction was at hand, he raises the question, shall not the judge of the earth do right? He thought in terms especially of the righteous element that might have been in Sodom. Now, it needs to be kept in memory and remembrance that Abraham had family in Sodom. We read way back in Genesis, the 13th chapter, how that when there was a choice made between the two land locations, Abraham saying to Lot, you choose one, I'll take the other. And it was not a choice between two equally good geographical areas. One was a rocky section, and I've traveled in that area. The other was the rich, fertile plain of the Jordan, and I've traveled in that area as well. And Lot, I think, acted a little bit selfishly, and he chose the better part of the choice. And he pitched his tent towards Sodom. And it's not long until he and his family were living in the very confines of Sodom itself. But Sodom at that time, way back in Genesis 13, was filled with people who had sinned and sinned grievously. But that's the direction of Lot's life. That's the choice that he made, evidently not thinking seriously about the impact that that kind of sensual society would have upon his own family. And you'll remember that when Abraham went to bat for this city, and this is what might be called intercession, now we need to keep in mind that there's a difference between intercession and mediation. According to 1 Timothy 2 and 5, there's only one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, but there can be any number of intercessors. Abraham acted as an intercessor here. Moses often acted as an intercessor in the wilderness. And, of course, we're told in 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, that we are to make prayers and supplications and giving of thanks and intercessions for all men. When somebody responds under God's second law of pardon and somebody is asked to lead the prayer, the one who does that is interceding for the one who is coming back and being restored. And so Abraham acts as an intercessor here. He raises the question, what if there be 50 righteous people in the city? Will the judge of the earth destroy the city in view of this many? And Abraham continued the intercession, the number goes from 50 to 45 to 40 to 30 to 20, and then it settles down at 10. And Abraham did not ask for a reduction of that number. I've sometimes wondered if 10 might have been the total of Lot's family. We do know that there were Lot and his wife, that makes two. We do know that he had two unmarried daughters, that makes a total of four. Mention is made in the book of Genesis about his sons, there's an S on that word, sons-in-law. That would imply that he had at least two sons-in-law and two married daughters. And if he had three sons-in-law and three married daughters, that would total out to be 10. And of course, we know the sequel of the account, that not that many could be found. In fact, only four left the city and only three actually escaped as Lot's wife turned in rebellion, looked back at the burning city, and became a pillar of salt. And we read about that in Genesis, the 19th chapter. And so this may have been the number of Abraham's actual family in the city of Sodom. But we are especially interested in that question that he raises as he speaks to the Lord. I believe the second person of the Godhead, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And if I'm right in suggesting that he is actually intercessing or interceding with the second member, of course we know from the teaching of the New Testament that it is not going to be the Father that will do the judging. We learn from John 5, 22 and 27 that God has committed all judgment unto the Son and therefore will not judge in person the world at the end of time. And so I think there might be a connection between the judge of all the earth here in Genesis 18 and 25 and the one who ultimately will judge the quick and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom. But I want to give a brief analysis of the question itself. Shall not. This is suggestive of a course of action that would be in total harmony with all of the attributes of deity. And then the judge of all of the earth. Abraham knew that he was not the judge of all of the earth. He knew that the great patriarchs that had preceded him, namely Seth and Enoch and Noah, that they were not going to be the judges of all of the earth. He knew that his future descendants, men like Samuel and David and Isaiah and others, that they would not be the judges of all of the earth. In the New Testament, we have mention made of John the Baptist, and he was not going to be the judge of all of the earth. And, of course, the apostles were not going to do the judging at the end of time, even though I'm aware of Matthew 19:28, how that as they sit upon the 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel, they do that by the means of their teaching. But Abraham recognized who is the judge of all of the earth. And the only one that can qualify is the Godhead for this, in particular, the second person of the Godhead. And shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Here we have his judgmental sovereignty. It reaches to all parts of the world. And it simply means that when Christ judges the quick and the dead, that the entire universe will be assembled before him. I remember a question being handed to me a number of years ago, and the question went something like this. What about people who lived before the flood? Will they have to make an appearance at judgment day? Well, there isn't anything in the Bible that suggests anything other than they'll be there, just like the ones who have lived this side of the flood. If it's going to be a universal judgment, it would have to include Adam and all the ones who live prior to the flood, as well as all of his descendants that would live after the flood. And so it is going to be an entire earth that is going to be judged by this great one. And then we have that expression, shall not the judge of the earth do right? That, of course, fits right in with the character that we know about God the Father, that we know about the second person, that we know about the third person. There are several attributes that might be mentioned about the Godhead. Brother Richard this afternoon talked about some of the attributes and some of the characteristics of God, such as holiness and justice and mercy and the like. Well, of course, one of those has to do with righteousness as well. One of the great truths that is expressed in the Old Testament is the righteousness of God. In fact, when Paul wrote his great thesis of the Roman epistle, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. I really don't believe that's a reference there to the righteousness of God in his own character, but to the plan of righteousness that he had given in the scheme of human redemption. Because the Jews who had been trained and cultivated under the Old Testament law, they were very much aware of the fact that God is a totally righteous God. I've been teaching a class on Wednesday night at Ripley for a number of weeks now, dealing with Psalm 119, the longest chapter in the Bible, I think the most unique chapter in the Bible. And, of course, a number of times in that chapter, mention is made of the righteousness of God, and especially the righteousness of his law, of his truth, of his ordinances, of his statutes, of his judgments. And so throughout the Old Testament, Almighty God and the other two are characterized by righteousness. And so the judge of the earth is going to do right. If the judge of the earth did wrong, then that would be against the very character and the very attractive and admirable attributes that we know that belong to the Godhead. But since the passage itself is talking about the judge of the earth doing right, I want to refer to some of the judgments that the Lord had upon people in the Old Testament. And, of course, the Bible teaches that there is more than one judgment. There's one final judgment, but there are various judgments that came upon the people in the Old Testament, and some of which came upon people in the New Testament as well. And in every single one of these, the judge of the earth did that which was right. For instance, there is a judgment that is rendered upon Adam and Eve. They were told in crystal clear language what would happen if they transgress God's positive divine law that you're not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and of evil. God let it be known that in the day that you eat, you shall surely die. And there wasn't any misunderstanding. Eve, in her conversation with a sly serpent, she knew exactly what the Lord had said in regard to the eating of this forbidden fruit. They knew what the penalty was going to be. And yet she succumbed to the seducements of the serpent, who was inspired, of course, by the devil himself. And she ate of the forbidden fruit, gave to her husband, and he also ate. Transgression had come. Sin had made an entrance into the hearts of the first couple. And as a result, they paid dearly. Each one of them receives punishment from the Lord. There is punishment that is meted out to Adam. There is punishment that is meted out to Eve. And, of course, they were banished from the Garden of Eden. Now, you and I do not share the guilt of Adam's sin. When you and I stand before the judge of the quick and the dead come judgment day, we'll not be held responsible for what that first human couple did in Eden. The only two that will give an account for that, if they never repented of it, will be Adam and Eve. Now, even though we do not bear the guilt, the Bible in neither testament teaches this erroneous Calvinistic concept of original sin that old Augustine helped to father and that Calvin crystallized into his own Calvinistic movement. There isn't any basis for that at all. But we do suffer the consequences from their sin. I sometimes have had people ask me, why do little children die? They die for the same reason that older people do. We're all separated from the tree of life. And as a result, we are going to meet that appointment. In fact, the New Testament tells us that it is appointed unto men once to die. And literally billions of people did that in the century that has just passed. And if we have another 93 years or 97 years in this present century, there'll be countless billions of others, most of us included, that will meet that appointment in this new century. And so we're separated from the tree of life. That's why the old and the young and the in-between die, go the way of all of the earth. But we do have to suffer the consequence of their sin in the Garden of Eden. God visited them with a judgment because of their transgression. And then we have the judgment that came upon Cain. So far as we know, he was the firstborn of Adam and Eve. I recently came across some information where a person took the view that he was not sure that Cain was actually the firstborn. Well, there's nothing in the Bible to indicate otherwise. And I'm under the impression that he was the firstborn son, and then came Abel, and then later on came Seth. I know some take the view that Cain and Abel may have been twins. I'm not sure that there's any sufficiency of evidence for that at all. But remember, Cain turned out to be bad. He was irresponsible and irreverent in his worship. And then he got mad at the Lord and mad at his brother and actually slew his brother. John looks back to that event in 1 John 3:13 and says, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one and slew his brother, and wherefore slew him, because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. If John is talking about literal slaying there, it may be that Cain actually cut the throat of Abel. That may have been the way that he committed this first murder here upon the earth. But for what he did, and then evading his own responsibility and being his brother's keeper and lying about where Abel was, he knew exactly what had happened to Abel, and he lied about the matter, and God had punishment that was meted out to Cain. He was going to be a wanderer. He's going to be a vagabond. The earth, and remember, he was a tiller of the soil, was not going to be fertile and productive for him, and that hit him in the very area where he made his living. But there is a judgment that is passed upon Cain for his evil. There is a judgment that came upon the peers of Noah, and that generation had become so wicked, had become so violent, that every imagination of their thoughts was only evil continually. And even as bad as our world is, we cannot say that every thought of every man's heart is evil continually. But that was God's assessment of Noah's generation. And out of the masses of men that lived in that time, there was only one family, Noah, his wife, their three sons, and their three wives, a total of eight that were judged to be righteous. The flood came upon that wicked generation. In fact, when Peter looked back on this event in 2 Peter 2:5, he said that the flood came upon the world of the ungodly. There is a judgment that came upon these people. Well, I believe the Lord did right in these judgments that came upon Adam and Eve, that came upon Cain, that came upon the people who lived in the time of Noah. And then there was the judgment that came upon Sodom. Not only was Sodom wicked and sinful, but also other neighboring cities were as well. Gomorrah is listed in that number, as well as Zeboim and Admah. There was really a fifth city. The destruction had been planned toward it, but that city was spared. And so four of the cities had fire and brimstone rained upon them. They had been given an opportunity to change. They decided they didn't want to change. They lived under a law that demanded the very kind of living they were not willing to do. And as a result, God's judgment came upon the sinful cities of the Jordan Plain. Was his judgment right? I believe that it was. And then we have the judgment that came upon Pharaoh and the Egyptian people. The land of the Nile had been blessed so abundantly. It is referred to as the breadbasket of the ancient world. The overflowing of the Nile left Egyptian soil so very fertile, and their grains and their crops brought forth plentifully. Here was a nation that was blessed and blessed plentifully, blessed and blessed abundantly. And yet instead of attributing their blessings to the God of heaven, the one that had sent them such blessings, they worshipped and served that which had been made, the creature instead of the creator. And they had an opportunity to do God's will when Moses went down along with Aaron and said, "Let my people go." Pharaoh was stubborn, and the Egyptian people under him were just as stubborn. And Pharaoh's reaction was, we had this discussed a little bit better, a little earlier in the day, "Who is the Lord that I should pay any attention to him?" Well, 10 plagues later, he was ready to pay some attention to the Lord. And he should have begun to pay some attention to the Lord of heaven before he actually did. But here's a judgment that came upon these people through the 10 plagues. I believe that probably every one of these plagues was aimed at some facet of their idolatry, as well as against their stubbornness and their disobedience. And then we have the judgment that God caused to come to the people and the wilderness. His own people, the very people that with his strong right arm of power, he had taken out of the land of captivity and removed them into the wilderness. And of course, they soon could have been in the land of Canaan if they had trusted the Lord. Now, when they left Sinai and went up to Kadesh Barnea, any good geographical map would show that they were only a short distance from the southern boundary of Canaan. Well, with the sending out of the 12 spies, 10 of them bringing an evil report, "The people are too powerful. We cannot take the land," and only Joshua and Caleb insisting that they could. And even though Moses, their lawgiver, had told them in the chapters of Genesis, Exodus, "Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil," that's exactly what they did. And God decreed that they were going to have to stay in that land nearly 40 years altogether until that generation 20 and above had perished. And so here's judgment that came upon these people. From time to time, there is specific judgment that came upon them when they would engage in idolatry, when they would engage in immorality, as they did at Beth Peor, as they would have little or no patience and confidence in God. There would be judgments of various kinds that came upon the people. And then there were judgments that came upon the people during the time of the judges. And this was a rather long Hebrew period of time, with Othniel the first and Samuel the last, 14 judges, counting Abimelech. I know some would discount him as a judge, but there were 15 counting him, one brave woman, Deborah. But it was a period, in fact, some Bible students refer to the period of the judges as the Dark Ages of Hebrew history, and I think that's a pretty accurate designation. But they went into various cycles. They would serve the Lord faithfully for a while, and then they would digress. They would begin to worship the gods and the goddesses of the land, and then God would sell them into the hands of either a near neighbor or a remote neighbor, and they would be held in oppression until they were brought to the knee of repentance. They'd call upon the Lord and his compassion and mercy and long-suffering. He would raise them up a deliverer. And this goes through cycle after cycle throughout the book of Exodus. These are various judgments that God caused to come upon his apostate people, every single one of which fell into the realm of the right. And then there were particular judgments that came upon the people after they were in the land of Canaan under the period of the kings, Saul being the first and Zedekiah being the last. There were a total of 41 of these kings, 3 over the United Kingdom and 38 over the 2 kingdoms that were divided, 19 over the north and 19 over the southern kingdom. And you can just about count in these kings only about 4 or 5 that were actually righteous. David of the three. Solomon, of course, apostatized in his later life, allowing outlandish women or foreign women to lead him into idolatry and the like. But not very many of the kings that ruled over these people were righteous at all. God caused various judgments to come upon them. Ultimately, the northern kingdom is taken into Assyrian captivity. About 135 years later, the southern kingdom is taken into captivity to the Babylonian people. These are judgments that God caused to come upon his people. And of course, in the New Testament, John the Baptist warned that the axe is laid to the root of the tree, that Judaism as a tree is going to be cut down, and ultimately it will with the coming of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Jesus warned about that destruction in Matthew 24 and Mark 13, Luke the 21st chapter, telling exactly what was going to happen when the Romans came against the city of Jerusalem, which they did in A.D. 70. And the city fell, and the temple was destroyed, and that we're told that about 1 million of them perished, losing their lives, and another 100,000, close to that number, sold into captivity. These are judgments that came upon these people. In Revelation 2 and 3, Jesus talked about judgments that would come upon some of the congregations in among the seven churches. Ephesus was warned that if they did not return to their first love, that the Lord would come and take away the candlestick, remove the congregation from the city of Ephesus. And Pergamos and Thyatira were warned that if they did not get rid of the false teachers, the doctrine of Balaam and the doctrine of Jezebel, that the Lord would come in judgment upon them. Sardis was warned that if they did not change from the unfaithful many and become faithful like the few were, that the Lord would come upon them as a thief in the night. And so there are various judgments that are mentioned both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, every one of which would be in the right. And of course, there's coming the ultimate judgment, the final judgment. The Father will not do the judging, according to Acts 17 and 31. He's already appointed Jesus to do that very thing. And of course, the judge of the earth will do right. There will be the right basis. He'll not come to any wrong conclusions. There'll not be any kind of perversion of justice, right, and honor upon that day. Because all the way through, when we're talking about what the judge of the earth would do, it's always in the right and never in the wrong. This is a vastly important question. Shall not the judge of the earth, of all the earth, do right? And with great force and finality, I say, yes, he does, has, and will. And I thank you.